Okay, so I have started. I started on Thursday. I have a joint position between the University of Waterloo and the Perimeter Institute. I'm generally interested in observational cosmology and the interface, particularly with theoretical cosmology. I'm involved in and have management roles, unfortunately, in a large number of collaborations. I am survey scientist for a project called EBOS, which is an ongoing galaxy redshift survey. I am leading a working group for quasar and galaxy clustering in a project called DESI, which is principally a US Department of Energy funded project building a new multi-object spectrograph for the Mayo telescope. And I'm also involved in Euclid, where I am one of four people doing the science coordination, the primary science coordination for the Euclid consortium. So just because I've only just started, my research interests are mainly revolve around galaxy surveys. It's something I started as a postdoc back in 1999 in Edinburgh, and I haven't really been able to give them up since. Because once you start doing something and you get known for it and you get grants in to do more of it, it's very difficult to stop doing it. But my interests have sort of broadened from just straight galaxy surveys to looking at different aspects of them, both going to galaxy formation and evolution, going into cosmological theory, but also in looking at specific objects such as voids, clusters, and so on within a galaxy survey. Okay, so the project I'm going to tell you about today is Euclid. And Euclid is designed you almost certainly don't know this, but I'm going to put it in anyway. It's designed to really understand and help solve the big problem, which is really understanding dark energy. The dark energy, as you all know, it's just a term. It's a term that's been thought up to describe the theoretical mechanism behind the current accelerated expansion of the universe. But just naming something doesn't mean understanding it. And there are many, many different ways in which the universe might be the reason behind the accelerated expansion. And one of the big questions is whether it's another energy density component or a modification to general relativity. And while these are kind of like give you equivalent large-scale behaviors of the universe, when you start looking at perturbations and the growth of perturbations, then you get different behavior with these different theories. In particular, if you start playing around with gravity, then you get different growth of structure than if you start introducing extra energy density components. So if you now decompose your metric into time-like and space-like metric fluctuations, then, as I'm sure you all know, something like gravitational lensing, which deals with relativistic particles, they depend on both the time-like and the space-like metric fluctuations. Whereas if you have something like the expansion history as probed by supernova or baryon acoustic oscillations that I'll talk about in a minute, then that only depends on the overall behavior, the scale factor of the universe. Whereas if you have something like redshift space distortions that depends on the peculiar velocities, the velocities that are driving the growth of structure, then that only depends on the time-like fluctuations. So if you have measurements of all of these, you can really get a handle on the physics that's driving this accelerated expansion. And Euclid is designed to do that. It's an experiment that does a galaxy survey, and in doing that galaxy survey, you can pick up the weak lensing of structure and galaxy clustering, which gives you baryon acoustic oscillation and redshift space distortion measurements. I will talk through the basics of Euclid. This is my standard seminar. I can give easily far more in-depth talks, but I'm going to introduce the basics of weak lensing, the basics of BAO and RSD, and show how they combine with Euclid to give us what will be incredible constraints. Euclid does a lot of other things. We'll get a lot of clusters, we'll get to type 1 over supernova, we'll be able to cross-correlate data with CMB and get all sorts of other cosmological information. Because once you have a galaxy survey, it provides a wealth of information about the universe. So here is a slice through a particular galaxy survey. Each dot here is a galaxy. This is angle. This is distance from us, redshift. And then, so we're throwing away all the wonderful detail about the actual galaxies themselves. We're not caring whether the galaxies are red, blue, large, small. We're just treating each as a tracer of the overdensity field of matter in the universe. And then we're using the positions of those galaxies and their projected shapes to trace that matter field. Once we've got this kind of data set, we can go and look at what happens basically between inflation and the start of matter domination to tell us what happens, you know, all of the physics that goes on, the Mazari's effect, the Baryon acoustic oscillation physics that goes into producing all the features in the transfer function and in the power spectrum. We can actually, with a galaxy survey, we can do better than the CMB, in that we have the projected scale of all of these fluctuations on the sky. So we can go away and measure distance redshift relationships, Hubble parameters, everything that depends on the projection of the galaxy survey. Redshift-based distortions allow us to measure velocities in the universe, the growth of structure itself. We can look at neutrino masses by looking at the effects of neutrinos in the early universe. Primordial non-Gaussianity, we can look at isotropy and homogeneity. We can look at the physics of galaxy formation and evolution, and the combination of geometry and growth constraints from the weak lens. So I'm not going to cover all of this in the next... How many hours do I have? And I'm only going to cover a little bit, specifically for Euclid. So the Euclid mission, it's a European Space Agency-led mission. It's a medium mission in the Cosmic Visions program, which means that its budget is below €1 billion. It's amazing. I've been involved in space missions for a little while. I was on an ESA panel where we were doing mission selection. And people just look at the budgets, and there's an extra couple of zeros on what you'd think a ground basic. And nobody raises an eyebrow or anything, right? Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent, which I tend to do in talks. It's primarily a dark energy experiment. We are now 3 years from launch on the baseline schedule that we're not going to hold to. So the launch was scheduled for about 2020. All likelihood it's going to be more like here now. And as this is being recorded, I'm not allowed to say anything more than that. It's a six-year mission, and there will be incremental public data releases. It's going to go off in a Soyuz It's going out to L2. You all know L2. It's this second Lagrange point in the Earth-Sun system. Basically, when you put a satellite in L2, it's a stable orbit, or it's a semi-stable orbit with respect to Earth. Basically, your satellite stays a fixed distance away from Earth, which is very good. It's in deep space, so it has a low background. Euclid is an infrared satellite, so you need to be able to basically radiate out the heat to make the detectors work. And so you want to be far enough away from the Earth to be able to do that. You also want to be basically, you know, being a fixed distance away from the Earth and in a stable orbit the whole year round means that actually the downlink and the telecommunications to the satellite are relatively straightforward as well. So, the basics, I'm sure you all know this, but at L2, basically you feel the gravitational pull of not just the Sun and the Earth, but it means that you have a stable orbit that orbits around the Sun with a period of exactly 1 year, but it's slightly further away from the Sun than the Earth is. Formally, this theory theory that I've just given in one sentence, it depends on circular orbits. In fact, when you've got the moon in play and not circular orbits and things, actually the satellite orbits around L2, but it's semi-stable, which means it actually has to expend very little gas in order to be able to stay there for a long, long time. And that's why so many satellites are going out to L2 at the moment. JWST is going out there and so on. So here is a few pictures of the spacecraft and the payload. This is the spacecraft. It's rather a boring spacecraft. Doesn't look anything like what you get in Star Wars or anything. Sun shield and the solar panels are the main thing you see. Then there's what's pretty much, as far as I can work out, a pretty standard platform for companies to build. It has such things as gas thrusters, tanks for cold gas to be able to position it, the communications download links, all the telemetry information and things on it. The interesting thing about any satellite mission is obviously the payload that consists of the telescope and the payload module, which contains the instruments. Here is the payload module's close-up. This is the key, you know, experimental piece of Euclid. Let me see if I can do this. Last time I did this, I got this hopelessly wrong, but the light from the telescope comes up here, it hits this mirror, bounced into that mirror, bounced into that mirror, bounced into here. This is a dichroic. Dichroic allows the infrared light through it. The visible light is reflected off, comes off a mirror here, I think, and is then goes into the visible camera. So basically, there are two instruments. There's a visible instrument and a near-infrared instrument, and they operate simultaneously. The visible camera is a pretty basic camera. It's a large, it contains a large number of CCDs. The near-infrared camera is slightly more interesting in that it's a little bit more novel. And the one that's giving the problems at the moment is the what you think would be the more standard visible camera. So here are close-ups of the two instruments. This is the near-infrared instrument, this is the visible instrument. These aren't actually the instruments. These are the ones that the university has produced not to actually go up in the satellite, but to go to ESA to sit in their vacuum chamber, to be shaken, to check that they survive the rigors of launch, that they can survive in deep space and still operate well. The near-infrared instrument, what you see here, the big thing is the Grissom wheels, the filter wheels, that change the filters, that change the different types of near-infrared light that you see. Here are close-ups of the actual filter wheels that will go up in the spacecraft. They are YJ and H filters, and then there are Grissoms as well, because the instrument is not only going to perform photometry in the YJ and H bands, but it's also going to perform slitless spectroscopy. So basically, in the optical path, instead of putting a filter to only pick up a certain color of light, you will put a Grissom to disperse the light from every object, so therefore replacing the image of the object with a little spectrum of the object at the location of the object. And from that, we can get spectra and measure redshifts and distances for our galaxy survey. It's a wide field telescope, right? So this is the field of view of Euclid compared to the Moon. Because whenever anybody ever compares a field of view of anything, they have to compare it to the Moon. And these are, for comparison, some of the Deep Hubble telescope deep fields. This is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field that gives you a basic idea of the field of view of Hubble. So you can get an idea of why Euclid is so different from Hubble. Basically, we're doing, space-based quality imaging, but over a full, you know, large area, 15,000 square degrees. So as I say, Euclid is going to do a panchromatic survey. It's got the visible and near-infrared channels. The data we're going to get are going to be horrible. They're going to look like this. What you see here is mainly cosmic ray strikes. The good thing about observing in space is you don't have the atmosphere. The bad thing is you don't have the atmosphere, which means you get hit by a lot more cosmic rays than you do for ground-based observing.
The magnetosphere.
Right. Can you not use atmosphere in a collective way? No, okay, fine. Right. Somebody else just completely thrown me as well. This is the near-infrared imaging. This is what the near-infrared spectroscopy is going to look like. So basically, you've taken every image of every object and you've dispersed it into a spectrum. So you can immediately imagine some of the problems we're going to face in reducing this data, right? Is that if you have two objects that happen to lie along the dispersion direction, their spectra are going to overlap. So if you see, for example, an emission line from a galaxy, you're not going to know whether it's from this galaxy or this galaxy. You're just going to see it somewhere along that spectrum. So to cope with that, we're actually doing multiple observations with different dispersion directions. So we've got three different dispersion directions, which are going to be used to try to solve this, what we call a confusion problem. This is quite a boring table of the fundamentals of the Euclid mission. The wide survey is 15,000 square degrees, which is about the most you can observe without getting incredible contamination from the Milky Way galaxy, both from extinction and stellar density. So even though we're observing in space, we still have to observe through our galaxy, which means we still face dust extinction, we still face stars. Euclid is going to do a 40 square degree deep survey as well. For non-cosmologists, this is perhaps the most interesting survey that it's going to do, because it's going to be an incredible... I'll show some examples. But to do this kind of survey from some of the ground-based telescopes we have at the moment would take a phenomenally long time. Yeah, I think pretty much you can skip over the rest of this. It's going to be an interesting survey. It's going to look like this. So this is the... Let me just get this right. This is the Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere. I'm going to, just going to say that vaguely now. This is obviously the Milky Way. This is the design of the survey. We have quite strong constraints on what we call solar aspect angle. So exactly how the telescope is pointing relative to the sun. If it points in a particularly the wrong way, it actually heats up and our observations aren't quite as clear. So the actual construction of the survey strategy and the pattern and the time at which it takes all of these observations is quite a complex thing to figure out. Because it's doing weak lensing observations, Euclid is a point and shoot telescope. So if you all, you know, Planck did a scanning strategy where it's continuously moving. That is not so good for weak lensing when you need galaxy shapes, high precision galaxy shapes. So Euclid instead is a point at this patch of sky and then dither off to point at a different patch of sky and gradually build up the survey in different imaging pieces. Okay, so let's talk about weak lensing first. Oh, any questions on the overall project? Everybody happy?
So where is the deep patches going to be?
That's a very good question. There are going to be, three main deep fields. Because of the strategy of keeping the solar aspect angle fixed, the easiest places for the telescope to have repeated observations are the North Pole and the South Pole, but they are pretty terrible for where people have put their current deep fields, which tend to all be equatorial. Even so, we're going to have a Euclid deep field in the north and the south, but we're also going to observe on that equatorial region some of the well-known, like CDFS, and some of the well-known deep fields. Okay, so weak lensing is, you know, you're all aware, basically the light from these galaxies, it comes on geodesics to us. What that means is that we actually get a shear of the galaxy shape. To understand this shear, just in the simple limits, if you make the weak field limit of low velocities, you make the limit of stationary field, you assume you've got a thin lens, so basically everything doing the lensing is very thin compared to the light path. You assume that it's transparent, there's a small deflection angle. You do all of those approximations, then the bend angle that you get of the light depends on the gravitational potential. You can write that gravitation, basically it depends on the divergence of the potential perpendicular to the line of sight. And so you can write the lens equation as the angle that you see compared to the actual angle to the source as depending on the gradient of a potential, a lensing potential. And you can actually look at the Jacobian of this mapping that you get out, and you can write that Jacobian basically as a distortion matrix of that actual true set, you know, field of positions of galaxies through to the actual field that you observe. It's obviously a mapping, and you can write that Jacobian of the lens mapping as a convergence term and a shear term, where the convergence term is basically an isotropic magnification that would transform a circle into a larger or smaller circle, and you can write the shear term as an anisotropic, basically a stretching type term, transforms a circle into an ellipse with axes. This is perhaps the strongest signal, but it's the hardest to measure, because if you have a galaxy and you don't know its intrinsic properties, it's very hard to tell whether it's fundamentally getting brighter or fainter with the lensing signal. So consequently, this, although it's in general weaker, is the one that people tend to use to measure weak lensing. It's because you know that on average, galaxies, if you stack up enough of them, should be circular in projection, right? There is no preferred direction in the universe, so if you see a coherent sheared signal, you know that is due to the lensing along the line of sight. I'm presuming you've all had this kind of talk on lensing many times before, right? Okay, fine. So, basically you can write down this power spectrum of the shear signal as a function of the power spectrum of the field along which the lensing is happening, projected. And we should bear in mind that the size of the signal that you're expecting for each galaxy is actually equivalent to the difference in ellipticity between the Earth and the Moon. Okay? So, the Earth is not a perfect sphere, neither is the Moon. The Earth has a different ellipticity, in fact it bulges out in the equator. That difference in the ellipticity that you see between these pictures is the average shear distortion that you expect from the galaxies we're going to observe in Euclid. Okay? So it's a phenomenally difficult measurement to do, and you will only get it by stacking galaxies and really, you know, beating down the noise by stacking. There are other issues. One is the big pixelization problem. You have an intrinsic galaxy, you add a shear, then your telescope causes a convolution because you're space-based, you don't have to worry about the atmosphere. Your detectors measure a pixelized image, and then that also contains noise. So actually, you have many of these kind of images, and these are the ones that you're trying to measure that shear signal from, that shear signal which is equivalent to the size of the difference between the Earth and the Moon. So the way that you try and solve this is to also look at point sources, stars, and stars tell you what would happen if the image, the actual object, was circular. And then you can use this to project back to understand exactly this shear signal for the galaxy. So one of the big problems for Euclid is that this PSF, the response of the telescope to an object, even if it doesn't have a shear signal, is color dependent. So if you have an object that is slightly redder and slightly bluer, you will have a different PSF. It will appear in your image slightly bigger or smaller. And we know that galaxies, you know, in general, galaxies are bimodal population. They're either red or blue. But they also have structure in them. And you know that the core of galaxies tends to be red and the outside of galaxies tends to be blue. And that changes for different galaxies. So even the color gradients within galaxies can bias the results. So it can even depend on whereabouts you're actually putting your isophote on a galaxy to depend on the shear signal that you measure. And the big problem is that the stars that you tend to observe don't have the same colors as your galaxies. So if you're correcting the observed shapes of the galaxies using the stars that you observe, and the stars are a different color to the galaxy, you'll be doing that correction wrong. And so Euclid, because it has one broad visible color, which it's going to do weak lensing with, it tends to have to do this sort of correction on average using simulations of this to correct for it. One of the other things you might worry about for measuring galaxy shapes is blending, where you have two faint galaxies so close together you can't tell they are two objects rather than one object, and you might think they're an elliptical galaxy rather than two individual galaxies close together. And again, that's something we're going to have to deal with. That's one of the reasons we want the deep field to really understand exactly how blending affects our observations. Although the intervening structure to these galaxy surveys, that does most of the weak lensing signal, there are also intrinsic alignments. You might think that galaxies themselves are intrinsically aligned. For example, if they grow because there's a tidal field and they happen to have ellipticities that lie preferentially along that tidal field, then you will find that nearby galaxies are themselves correlated in terms of the shapes. And if you didn't know that and allow for it, you would think that was cosmological in origin. One of the big issues is not galaxy-galaxy intrinsic alignment, but it's actually what's called galaxy shear intrinsic alignment, where a galaxy is itself aligned with the dark matter that's doing the lensing of a different galaxy. and then this actually causes problems. The good thing about this is it has a redshift dependence that's very different to the lensing signal. It also is, you know, models are doing a better and better job of dealing with this. The final issue for a lensing survey is dealing with photometric redshifts. We're going to want to split the galaxies up into redshift bins. For the weak galaxies doing the weak lensing, we won't have spectroscopic redshifts. We'll be getting the redshifts from the colors of the galaxies. We'll be doing what's called photometric redshifts. That means that we're going to be reliant on ground-based imaging and lots of different data sets, including CFIRS, to tell us the redshifts of the galaxies and to allow us to basically do topological weak lensing by splitting into bins to understand the evolution of structure along the line of sight.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. So you're saying you get some colors from Euclid, but then you need much more from...
So from Euclid, you get the near-infrared colors, but the visible only does one broadband color, and that's not enough to tell you enough redshift information to split into redshift bins. So we need the ground-based imaging to tell us the actual information we need.
So I'm really confused. So that means that every single galaxy that you map with Euclid is also mapped from the ground.
Yes. Yes.
So then what's the point of Euclid?
You get the high precision shapes from Euclid, right?
Shapes, right?
Yes. Yes.
So,
okay. For weak lens. Okay. But the projections are very good if we can beat down all these systematic errors and problems and be limited by our statistical errors, then this is actually some plots I just took from this paper. There are more precise plots. It all's obviously these kind of predictions, they all depend on what you assume for priors and things. This actually assumes the least priors of any prediction I've ever seen, but it still shows that you can get model independent constraints on growth and expansion from the weak lensing only. Okay, so the part of Euclid that I'm perhaps most interested in is galaxy clustering. Galaxy clustering is this idea that when you look through one of these projected fields of galaxies, then the galaxies you see are clustered. They're not randomly distributed. There is a coherence to them. And to think about clustering, if anybody shows you, for example, a correlation function, the mental picture that at least I have in my mind is taking one of these galaxy surveys, throwing down sticks of a certain length and saying, what's the probability that I find at both ends of the stick a galaxy? And if that probability is greater than you would get if the galaxies were just randomly distributed in that volume you've covered, then that sample is clustered on the scale of the stick length. If there's fewer pairs of galaxies, then it's less clustered. That is the definition of the correlation function. It's just the excess probability of finding pairs of galaxies where you've got one galaxy located at R and one galaxy located at R plus D, where D is your stick. Okay. And then statistical homogeneity means that it doesn't matter where you put the stick, you get the same expected probability. Statistical isotropy of the universe means that it doesn't matter what direction you put your stick. Okay. And then the power spectrum is just that excess probability, it defines the correlation function. The power spectrum is just the Fourier transform of that. If you want to have the same kind of analogy, mental picture, whenever somebody tells you about the power spectrum, you should think about throwing down not sticks, but throwing down Fourier waves and asking for the density squared to be aligned with that Fourier wave. But you can still use the same kind of mental picture to deal with it. Okay, so barren acoustic oscillations, there are a particular signal in this excess probability. This is examples of measured correlation functions. And you find that if you do this measurement from a galaxy survey and you throw down sticks that are 100 h to the minus 1 megaparsecs long, you find an excess in the pairs of galaxies, okay, compared to sticks that are slightly shorter or slightly larger. Whenever you Fourier transform something that has a feature, like a sharp feature, you take the Fourier transform of top hat or something, you get a sink. Same thing means that when you take the Fourier transform of the correlation function, you get oscillations in your power spectrum. These oscillations you can also think of as being, you can derive in a Fourier picture, okay? So this is the barren acoustic oscillation signal. It basically starts off from the early universe physics, post-inflation, or whatever theory you want of the early universe. But before matter domination, where you've got these acoustic waves propagating out before recombination happens, radiation splits away from the baryons, basically radiation pressure no longer drags material, and it leaves material in this spherical shell around perturbations at recombination. So if you just had one density spike, that would become a density profile with a spherical shell around it. If you take this mental picture and you linearly superimpose this idea on a field of perturbations, then you get the sort of field of perturbations that we expect in a galaxy survey. And so what we're expecting is an excess of pairs of galaxies around this scale. This is showing the size of the scale that we expect as a function of redshift. And so obviously it's not something your eye can pick up. You can't look at this picture, like slice of galaxy survey, and say, aha, there's an excess in pairs of galaxies separated by this particular distance, right? But if you measure the correlation function, it's there very clearly. So this same physics is the physics that drives the peaks and troughs in the CMB power spectrum that you've all seen from Planck, right? But the key thing about galaxy survey is not just that it's there, because it's there in the CMB, and you can measure the information from the CMB actually with more fidelity than from a galaxy survey. But from a galaxy survey, the idea is that you can use it as a background to set a standard ruler, that you can then look at the projected size of it, right? So having this excess of pairs of galaxies at this BAO scale means that you have a scale in the universe that you can use as a standard ruler. And if you had a galaxy survey with different redshifts and you saw this scale at those different redshifts, you would be able to work out basically the distance to those redshifts modulo the actual size of the ruler. And the size of the ruler depends on the co-moving sound horizon at recombination, which is basically just how far this spherical wave could get out before the physics that was driving it slowed down and stopped. Now, so I told you that in the universe, statistical homogeneity and isotropy means that it doesn't matter what direction you put your stick in. That is true in the true universe, but in the observed universe, it's not true. And that's because we observe galaxies in different ways along the line of sight and across the line of sight. Along the line of sight, we measure galaxies with redshifts, and across the line of sight, we measure galaxy positions with angles. So when you're projecting this BAO scale, in the radial direction, it depends on the Hubble parameter. So you can think of this as being, we measure a separation in redshift. Our theory gives us a separation in distance, so the two are related. It's a small separation by dd by dz, which is the Hubble parameter. In the angular direction, we're measuring angles. Our theory gives us co-moving distances. The two are related by the angular diameter distance. So although in theory, in the true universe, the correlation function would not depend on the angle that you're throwing down your stick into your survey, when we analyze a survey, there is a reason to split in direction parallel to the line of sight and across the line of sight. So this is the intensity plot of a correlation function. Now, taking that stick and splitting it into components along the line of sight and across the line of sight. And so your baryon acoustic oscillation feature, the bump, is now a ring. And if you've got everything correct, that should be a perfect circle in this plot. But if, for example, you've got your Hubble parameter wrong, when you're translating from redshifts to distances, you would find it would be squashed in this direction. And if you've got the angular diameter distance wrong, you'd find it would be squashed in this way. So there's a famous test called the Alcott-Pachinsky test, which basically just says these should be circles. And if I get H times dA right, I'll get circles in this kind of plot.
But to use that, right, you know, so your selection of your galaxies has to be isotropic as well, right?
What do you mean selection of galaxies?
Well, so not all of your galaxies have spectra, right?
Say that again.
You don't measure spectra for all the galaxies.
No.
Right, you know? And so if the selection of the targets, you know, depends upon, like, density, you know, line of sight density, for example.
Right. Yes, right? It does. Yeah.
Which it does, right?
Yeah.
That'll then introduce, it'll produce anisotropy in the galaxies.
So are the two points here. One is, when we measure that excess clustering, we do it relative to the volume that we've covered, including the radial distribution of galaxies and the angular distribution of galaxies. Right. So we commonly quantify that mask of the survey by means of what we call a random catalog, a Poisson sampling of the region.
Right.
So we've taken out the actual survey projection on the sky and the actual survey distribution radially. So the only thing left is that potentially if you looked at all of the galaxies, you might imagine that if you looked at them completely, there might be more pairs in the angular direction than the radial direction than you would expect from just a geometrical argument, as if you'd sampled the whole volume in total. But there would be that excess both in the galaxies and in the randoms. And you would know exactly what that is. So when you calculate this kind of plot, you've completely taken that out.
I feel Neil is not convinced.
He doesn't have a convinced look on his face.
Yeah.
This is my normal physician.
Oh, really?
Okay, we can talk more.
Okay, but yeah, no, we have allowed for that. It is a big issue, actually. I mean, when you do a galaxy survey, you are looking at a particular patch of the universe, right?
That's right. But if I preferentially, avoid high-density regions...
Ah, now, density-dependent selection.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I thought you were just talking about general selection. So density-dependent selection, you can think of it in two ways. One is you can just think about it, if you select a particular type of galaxy, you are doing a density-dependent selection of some sort, right? If I look at red galaxies, I'm preferentially looking at clusters. If I look at blue galaxies, I'm preferentially looking at the field.
I hope, right?
Yeah, unless the universe has completely gone mad. But but that, in general, is dealt with in the bias, okay? And if you accept something like peak background split bias model, if you go to large enough scales, you get a scale-independent bias of a particular value for that class of galaxies.
Right. Yeah, so I guess I was more worried about things like the fiber collision limit in Sloan.
Oh, like this is that. A talk on Euclid. I've got a whole missing galaxy talk I can give. Next week, maybe.
If there were something similar, analogous in Euclid, then I'd just worry about anisotropy on large scales coming from that.
We've got a really, really good solution to this problem that we only put out a year ago that I really want to talk about now, but I'm not, because this is a Euclid talk. And I'm not going to have time to put another talk on the end of it.
Well,
right.
We have 10 years left there, so...
Yeah, okay. Okay. Ritchie space distortions. Okay, are another effect on the clustering at the tree of galaxies. Basically, what we're talking about is measuring a redshift of those galaxies and translating that into a distance. You're assuming when you do that, that all of that redshift, all of the velocity difference between the observer and the galaxy is due to Hubble expansion. If it's not, and it isn't, then you get coherent movement when you translate that redshift into distance, you're translating the galaxy population incorrectly, and you're putting those galaxies down in what we call redshift space rather than real space. So we're saying we're translating from a redshift to a distance. That's giving us galaxies in redshift space. And that redshift space is not the true distribution of galaxies. It's just what we've got. And then we're measuring that clustering in redshift space, not real space. And so when we look at this kind of plot of the intensity plot of the correlation function, remember this is perpendicular to the line of sight, this is parallel to the line of sight, then we see this squashing on small scales. And what's happening here is that galaxies preferentially live in clusters. And if you imagine looking at a cluster from below, then the galaxy on the near side of the cluster to you will be moving slightly towards that cluster because the cluster's growing. The galaxy on the far side of the cluster to us will be moving towards the cluster, so it'll be moving slightly towards us. And when we add these extra peculiar velocities into the Hubble expansion velocities and translate into distances, in redshift space, we will see that cluster as being squashed. So that pair of galaxies, you know, this excess pair that had the stick of this length, has been squashed into a shorter stick. And so when you look at the correlation function, you get this squashing along the line of sight. So this squashing is nasty in that it actually, well, it gives you the wrong map of the sky, but it's great in that it actually gives you a handle of the velocities at which structure is growing. And so you can measure the amount of squashing, basically, and you can get constraints on the growth rate of structure on the very largest scales. So basically, this is pretty much directly constraining how fast structures are growing, perturbations are growing in the universe through gravity. If you remember back before, this only depends on the time-like metric fluctuations, whereas the weak lensing I talked about before depended on this combination of time-like and space-like metric fluctuations. And then you've also got this test of expansion history. And so these are prediction plots for Euclid, basically showing the redshift range that Euclid will cover. The spectroscopy will cover redshift 0.9 to redshift around 1.9, and that basically we're going to really stitch up these kind of measurements. So Euclid and DESI that I'm not talking about today, it represents this sort of logarithmic improvement of galaxy surveys that we've had. So in this highly scientific plot, which is publication year against predicted distance error from a galaxy survey, you'll see that some of the surveys I was working on way back as a postdoc, down through to the predictions for Euclid and DESI, we've got this logarithmic improvement in basically how well we're measuring the power spectrum. That's kind of a dry way of putting it. Here's a better way. So this is now increasingly old, but I haven't had time yet to update it. This is the power spectrum as we measured it a couple of years ago from the BOSS survey. And this is a prediction of what we'll get from one redshift slice. We get about 10 of these slices from Euclid, right? So we're going from this kind of measurement of the power spectrum, and the inset shows the baryonic acoustic oscillations, through to this. So this kind of represents this improvement that we saw, well, some of you are almost certainly too young to have seen it, but where we had Boomerang and Maxima just about showing us a peak in the CMB, through to WMAP and Planck showing us this wonderful CMB power spectrum. This is what we hope Euclid's going to do as well. We're going to go from approximately measuring, you know, with a 4 or 5 sigma BAO through to really getting precise, you know, using this as a tool to measure cosmological expansion. This improvement of precision is a factor of 30 improvement of statistics from current data. This comes at a cost, and the cost is that to really realize any of these statistical improvements, we're going to need to really get good control of our systematic errors. For Euclid, this really means understanding some things about the galaxies that we're observing. With a slitless spectroscopy, we're going to be observing galaxies which are called H-alpha emitters. They have this strong emission line, H-alpha emission line. One of the problems up till now in Euclid has been telling ESA and the other space agencies that we want to observe emission line galaxies, but we don't know how many of them there are actually in the universe. Because we don't know how many of these H-alpha emitting galaxies there are to within a factor of 2. So all these space engineers, they're used to creating satellites in a really precise way, and they're used to setting requirements on the surveys that will result. For example, we will be able to observe this galaxy down to this depth, to this signal to noise, and those are precise numbers. And then they've been asking us to write science requirements documents for a sample that we don't know what it's like to within a factor of 2. It's been quite a challenge.
This is better than LIGO uncertainty, I guess.
True. Although I think that just improves significantly, right? Yes.
Makes it all more exact.
Yeah. The latest estimates are that we will get 4,000 sources per square degree. This is something that's currently being worked on. A lot of the spectra will come from single emission line. H-alpha is quite commonly blended with nitrogen too. And consequently, we will get a lot of false positives. We will get a lot of galaxies that we, you know, think are at a certain redshift, but they're at a different redshift. Possibly because we've mistaken the H-alpha line for a different line or so. This is the actual distribution of H-alpha galaxies that we see depends on stray light and extinction. So this is our predicted sky map of the H-alpha galaxies that we can see with Euclid. So this is what we have to remove in order to get at the cosmological signal. Interestingly, a lot of this is zodiacal background.
Right, so those are the lobes that... is that the ecliptic?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah. False positives come from a number of different emission lines being mistaken as being H-alpha, which would throw the redshift of the galaxies away from their actual redshift. So this is the line that we think most of our galaxies will have. Euclid is designed to pick this line up between a redshift of 0.9 and 2. But if we have basically, you know, O3 emitters at slightly higher redshift, we will pick up as well and have those in the sample.
What's the resolution of this little spectrum?
It is pretty low. It's like 200 or so.
200. Thank you.
Angstroms. Okay. Yeah. Right. Calibrating the data set is going to be a challenge. We've been looking at doing things like UberCal that Dustin could give a talk on, but I won't. Basically, you look at overlaps between these pointings and you match objects in the overlaps in order to build up an overall pattern for exactly how things like stray light and zodiacal background are affecting your densities that you observe. What we've just done, actually, with a postdoc in Portsmouth a couple of years back, we did some tests, and we have actually now managed to get Euclid to change its pattern of observations to do a pattern that is more conducive to doing UberCal by having better overlaps between observations. So we were quite pleased by that. It's still going to be a challenge, though. Okay. Is that it? Oh, no, hang on. There's more. Oh yeah, okay. No, I'm just checking because I hid some slides because I figured by now I'd be running out of time and I was right. Just to say, people here won't be that interested by it, but I think it is pretty exciting. If you look at some galaxy survey like the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, most of the papers that came out of it were not papers doing what the survey was designed to do. Right? So these surveys, the experiments, they're designed to do a particular measurement, right? Almost all of the scientific papers that come out of these projects are not related to that measurement. They're related to other exciting things that people have figured out to do with a wonderful data set. And Euclid is going to provide a wonderful data set for this. So if you take the wide survey that Euclid's going to do, the 15,000 square degrees in the near infrared and the broadband visible colors, if you took a 4-meter class near-infrared telescope on the ground, such as VISTA, and you dedicated it to doing this kind of survey, it wouldn't do it with the same resolution, and it would take 680 years simply to reach the same depth. Okay? The deep survey of 40 square degrees down to the same depth would take 72 years with VISTA. So basically, you can start to imagine that this data set, once it's provided and out there and available for people to download, it will stop people having to go to telescopes and observe their favorite object. But instead of going to a telescope and spending 4 nights observing your favorite object, you will just look in this database and find that patch of the sky, and you will get those objects from it. So if you look at any of the sets of objects that a survey like this will produce, and you look at what you might get from a ground-based observation, and you look at what Euclid will produce, you find that these numbers are significantly higher. So mining this data set that Euclid's going to produce for finding your favorite type of star or your favorite type of galaxy merger is going to be an industry in itself, right? So Euclid had this enormous number of people setting up the database such that you can mine it for these kind of tests of finding these objects. Here's a picture. This is Sloan at redshift 0.1, image of, M51, as projected, Sloan redshift 0.1. This is what Euclid would see for the same galaxy at the same distance. This is what it would see for a galaxy at far higher, further away, basically a higher redshift. So you can see, I mean, basically, you know, as a resource, Sloan is used phenomenally, a large amount of people looking for survey objects, finding objects, wondering about the colors, types of galaxies, and so on. And you can imagine the big leap forward that Euclid is going to produce. You're going to be looking at images like this rather than images like this in order to understand things like bars, colors of galaxies, special classes of galaxies, and things like that. So at the moment, there's a lot going on in Euclid. We're just about reaching the limit of the input we can have into the mission design. Certainly, we can't affect the hardware anymore. That ended a few years ago. We can still influence the survey, as we've just had, changing the dither strategy. There is a big push at the moment. We're doing what's called a science performance verification, which is a full end-to-end test of Euclid data systems, basically mimicking the Euclid survey. And to do that, we've got one of the very largest simulations that's ever been produced. We're calling it flagship simulation because it's a superlative nobody has used yet for a simulation. It's basically a 3 qubit gigaparsec, trillion dark matter particles, and we're using it to produce fake light cones of Euclid. These are examples. These are all the galaxies. These are the ones that are visible, we'll get for weak lensing. These are the ones that we'll get for spectroscopy. Okay, so that's it. I've talked a little bit about BAO, RSD, and weak lensing. I've given you some of the details of Euclid, and hopefully I've at least enthused you about what's to come when launch happens a little while after 2020. And this is the key reference for Euclid, but there are many others I can supply later on. Okay, thanks.
Been one most difficult thing in getting that's driving the delay, or
yes, there has, and I know slightly too much to be able to tell you what they are. But I mean, a lot of the problems are, I mean, the main delays are obviously hardware related. They're to do with the instrumentation. There have been some publicized delays to do with, for example, the back end electronics on near infrared detectors. They were giving to signals. There are other less publicized issues. One of the things is basically to do the near infrared observations, you need to have a very stable platform that can dissipate heat. And that heat dissipation is a big problem for all of these types of missions. And I think it's fair to say that's one of the things that Euclid is looking at very closely at the moment.
You might have said this, but how long do they, so at a given patch, how long does Euclid stare at it?
Oh, exposures are 580 seconds. And you have 4 times covering roughly each patch.
And it will just store the, nothing about the time accumulation of that exposure, just the net.
Yes, that is correct, yes.
Did you mention how long after the launch that data release
was? I didn't. there will be a proprietary period, but there is a plan to make it public in sequential data releases, and I think they will be at least a year to 18 months after the final data is taken for that particular data release chunk. But there is a big push to make the data public as soon as possible within the collaboration. That is obviously balanced with the politics of it all. Because, oh, Okay, there's a whole new talk on politics. I just saying the word politics with respect to Euclid just has made me incredibly tired already. Sorry. Dustin?
Everybody's being too nice to you so far, so I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
Just on your Moore's Law plot,
yeah.
You have things going down beautifully.
Yeah.
But at 1%, there's a little bit of a break around systematics. And so you might believe that systematics are on like a different, on like the quality of the analysis is on a different curve than kind of the number of detectors we can put in space and stuff. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that?
No, that's not a difficult question. It's a very good point, right? This is a statistical error plot, right? This is just taking the volume that you're covering and the number density of galaxies and working out what you could theoretically try to get. And as I said in the at the end, actually, at some point here, we will go from being dominated by the statistical error to the systematic error, right? You're saying it's here. I don't think it's here. I actually think it's more like here. But, you know, we will deal with that, right? And actually, a lot of the work that I've been doing, you've been doing, we've been doing recently is designed to try to figure out what we will need to do as we go down this way. So your question, Neil, about missing galaxies, that was one of the things we did to try and solve that problem of density-dependent selection, and we think we've solved it. There are other issues, particularly one Dustin's involved in, forward modeling of objects in imaging data. So we get a lot of these systematics where if we see a lack of galaxies in one part of the sky, we want to know that's because it's cosmologically not there, not just that the imaging data wasn't quite so deep there and we don't understand that. And one of the ways to get that, solve that, is to put fake sources into the imaging data, extract them exactly as you do for the real data, and then see their distribution. And that's something that's being worked on there as well.
So one question is,
is yours involved with?
Yeah.
Yeah. So is that, how would that complement Euclid? I guess I don't.
So it complements it in two ways. One is DESI tends to be at a lower redshift than Euclid. So Euclid is being optimized to observe galaxies between a redshift of 0.9 and 2. DESI is going all the way down basically to redshifts less than 0.3 in something called the Bright Galaxy Survey. And then out, and it peters out at redshift of 1.3, 1.4, where you can't select or observe emission line galaxies anymore. It does have an extension to higher redshift, but it's nowhere near the density of Euclid. So they're actually very complementary, and we actually designed them this way. And we changed Euclid such that it was focused on the higher redshift end on the basis that we're not spending €1 billion to stick a satellite up into space to observe and measure redshifts at a redshift of 0.2. Because that would be insane. Otherwise, yeah, there are an incredible number of cross-checks you can do. One of the nice things that's going to be done is cross-correlating weak lensing from Euclid with galaxy clustering in DESI. So when you do the cross-correlation of weak lensing and galaxy clustering, you want to be doing the galaxy clustering where the weak lensing kernel is strongest, so over the redshifts where you're doing the weak lensing. And DESI is actually pretty good for matching the redshifts where the Euclid galaxies are going to be lensed.
Is the space density of the targets, for DESI, versus Euclid going to be like similar, or is it larger for one than the other? Or, like Sloan, like LRGs.
Okay. So DESI is going to be slightly denser at lower redshifts. Euclid is going to be denser at higher redshifts, right?
Okay.
So if you plot like N of Z,
right.
DESI tails off, Euclid picks up.
So things like video reconstruction, on small scales, be easier if you have like say DESI compared to what was possible with Sloan.
What we have found is that density field reconstruction is actually reasonably independent of galaxy density. So when we designed BOSS, we did it with a higher density than NP of 1 in order to try to help reconstruction. But if we look at BOSS mocks and we divide the density into 3, so we only keep a third of the galaxies, and we try and do reconstruction, we get equivalent improvements. And that's because density field reconstruction is really only dependent on the large scale modes. And so you can go down to reasonably low densities and still get those large scale modes well enough to be able to do density field reconstruction. So we can do reconstruction with both DESI and Euclid over their core redshift ranges without a problem. But they are designed to go well over MP of 1 in the regions where they're most sensitive to in redshift.
So the small scales aren't useful, you're saying, for reconstruction?
Not so much, no.
That must mean then that the model for, for the reconstruction then is suboptimal, right?
Model for re- so in, when you're doing reconstruction, almost this is going way off the topic of this, but I didn't even mention reconstruction in the talk. But when you do reconstruction, you're trying to get back the Zeldovich displacements, right? Not the nonlinear component. You're trying to undo the Zeldovich displacements, which means you're trying to look at an evolved density field and understand what the Zeldovich displacements were.
Well, my goal is just to recover the linear density fields, right? And so,
But there is also...
So we have to be careful what we're saying linear in. Are we seeing linear in the density or the displacements? So when you do reconstruction, you could reconstruct... If you just had an evolved field where you only had Zeldovich motions, you would still have this broadening of the correlation function that you would still want to undo. So in that sense, you still have reconstruction, even when you've got a linear field, when you're talking about linear being in the displacement. So you really only want to pick up that linear Zeldovich when you're doing reconstruction. And you only need the large scale modes to do that.
But there's also fingers of God that you want to remove. I guess maybe that's the...
Fingers of God you would need the small scale for, yes.
All right.
Okay.
Are there no more questions?
Oh. Yeah.